was a configuration of binary variables. So now let's think of them as either, you know, projective measurements of a qubit, say in Z, X, or Y, or some other basis. And we're going to just call each one of those configurations just sigma now. So sigma still refers to the visible units, but just think of them as configurations of projective measurements in some chosen, what we'll call a computational basis. So it's like a reference basis, something that's fixed by, you know, the hardware, or the device, or whatever it is that you're performing measurements on. So we're still taking this philosophy of training an RBM. So last lecture we talked about the basic procedure for how to train an RBM by minimizing the Kullback-Leibler divergence, which I called DKL. That's small p. So big P is still the probability distribution that underlies this data. And what we'll do today is talk about how we relate that to a wave function. Training will use the Kullback-Leibler divergence as a cost function. So likelihood estimation using contrastive divergence. Is an algorithm for efficient training. So again, this is an algorithm by Hinton and coworkers. And sometimes it's called CDK, where K is a different K than the K on the KL divergence. K refers to how many steps in the Markov chain you run to produce an estimate of that negative phase. How many block Gibbs? Steps, you know, for each time you send in a set of training data. The negative phase is the second term that we derived in the cost function. So what we're doing today is we're going to look at some data for trained machines and so on. But what we're going to do is calculate observables. Trained RBMs. And we'll do this we'll do this with classical data to begin, and then we'll start talking about quantum mechanical data. So everyone ignore the top board. It appears to be stuck from yesterday. So this will be what I call state reconstruction. It could be quantum state reconstruction, but we'll start with classical state reconstruction. So let's just frame the discussion by imagining that I have a probability distribution underlying this data that is intrinsically classical. Think about the, say, 2D Ising model, something you've studied, that has a Hamiltonian, sum over sigma z, ij. This refers to nearest neighbor sites on, say, a two-dimensional square lattice or something like that. And then P is the Boltzmann distribution. So this is your Hamiltonian, which depends on sigma. And if I call C sigma vector, you know, the configuration of sigma z spins that occurs on that two-dimensional lattice. So this would be the unknown target distribution that I'm talking about here in the KL distribution. So you can imagine, like we've already talked about, reconstructing this probability distribution with the parameters of the restricted Bolson machine. There's no reason why that won't work. And I'll show you data for it. And you can imagine that if you have some sort of two-dimensional lattice, say, I don't know how to draw this. Oh my god. Okay, whatever. That each one of these bonds, so each one of these is a nearest neighbor ij, this is site I and j, then each one of these bonds could be mediated through two weights to a hidden unit, you know, in the RBM. So from that you can imagine that an RBM would need something like, so in this case it's 2n, where n is the number of spins or qubits. We need 2n hidden units for an exact representation. So that kind of frames the discussion about the representational power or the expressiveness of an RBM. You know, you can imagine that these are the, you know, these are the weights, these are the WIJs, that's IJ there, so this is the WKLs, you know, that you have to train accurately to get a good approximate distribution through the KL divergence. Then you can test this. Or verify, maybe. Your training. You can do it through the calculation of observables. So we'll calculate something like energy, specific heat, magnetization, susceptibility, things like that. So in this case, for the 2D Ising model, we know, quote unquote, the ground truth, because you know how to make a Metropolis Monte Carlo to exactly measure these things on finite size lattices. So what we'll do today is show reconstructions of these types of quantities in a Bolson machine, and we'll in particular address basically this question here about how many hidden units we need to represent the Ising model. So the fact that you can do this with a classical Ising model also implies that you can do reconstructions like this with any wave function that's positive and real. So imagine a quantum system where you can find or choose a reference basis where all the coefficients of expansion are positive and real. So here's a wave function. Here's a basis. Let me call that psi sigma, right? Positive. And if each one of those coefficients, that's this part, that's this wave function projected onto that basis element. So anytime that those are real, then by the Born rule, essentially the statistics of measurements performed on that basis are governed by a straight up probability distribution that completely represents the wave function. Okay, so I'll say P in that reference basis is psi in that reference basis square, which is just psi squared. So there's no complex phase, you know, everything's just an amplitude, and the probability distribution is exactly the wave function. So in the RBM, you can represent this exactly with the machine, or not exactly, but accurately with the machine that we've already talked about. It's just something parameterized by weights and biases. And as long as you're taking measurements in that reference basis in the wave function, you can just imagine as being square root of the marginalized distribution. This is still. You've still traced out the latent space over the hidden units. Right? So, you know, replace everywhere that you see p, this is small p of lambda, replace it with the wave function squared, and train as usual, you have a representation of the underlying wave function. So you should still ask questions like, what is the scaling of this approach, or what is the, you know. Number one, can you still represent the underlying wave function with a number of parameters that scales polynomially, you know, with the size, with the number of qubits? So what is this, what is the scaling with respect to the number of qubits? And you can also ask how many measurements are needed. Your accurate reconstruction. Something you could ask in the previous example too. And you can address these questions with the same strategy of calculating physical observables. So just like I was calculating a physical observable, if I go back to lecture one, this is over the visible layer here. I can think of observables that I can calculate in the quantum mechanical system too. And these take two different forms, off the, diagonal and off diagonal. So if I consider O, I'll drop the visible subscript. So I'm defining an operator over the visible units, which is the, you know, the number of qubits. And I want to calculate the expectation value. Let me just write it in general. So let me imagine that I have matrix elements, right? These can be off diagonal. I'll expand this in terms of sigma and sigma prime. Let me just write what I'm doing first. So this is just the expectation value here. I'm implying that I'm calculating this in the trained RBM. Okay, so let me expand over two Bayes sets. That's my operator. This will be my matrix element. Sigma, sigma prime. Each one of these is just square root of the probability distribution. Right, so let's call this the matrix element. O, sigma prime, sigma. If I'm diagonal, if my operator is diagonal in a computational basis, okay, so magnetization of sigma z or something like that, if sigma z is my computational basis, then everything's simple. So if O, I just plop in O sigma sigma prime delta say sigma sigma prime into that expression, and then my expectation value will just give me something like, you know, basically a classical, you have two square roots of P, so it's just basically a classical expectation value like we've been calculating all along, right? No surprise there. This is basically the same thing that I'm gonna do over here in the classical case. But in quantum mechanical systems, we can also have off-diagonal operators, right? So if they're Hermitian, they're correspond to observables. And so I can form off-diagonal expectation values. Then sigma prime whatever order I'm writing that in, doesn't matter. So there's a trick here that people use in, that I learned from people who do variational Monte Carlo, which is basically to frame this as an expectation value, which I can then frame as an estimator over the data set, or the generated data, if you will, weighted by that marginalized distribution. And it's just to regroup terms. So I can write this like, sigma p lambda sigma. Now here's my sigma prime. And I'm basically multiplying and dividing by root p lambda, which is the Boltzmann machine. So what this is an expectation value of some operator, but this thing is the operator. They call it a local estimate. Of that off-diagonal operator. So this is a trick you can use to basically tease out, you know, off-diagonal expectation values, or expectation values off-diagonal operators, on a machine that's essentially completely classical. All you need to know is the form of the operator that you're interested in. I mean, you have to know what you're measuring. But if you know what you're measuring, you just basically plug in this thing. Computationally, that local estimate or local estimator has to be sufficiently sparse that this makes sense, you know. So something like a density matrix doesn't make sense. Something like the expectation value of, I don't know, sigma x magnetization in a transfer field Ising model does make sense.
Why is that the case? Why does it have to be sparse?
It just has to be sparse to avoid like an exponentially exploding estimator. You have to make sure you're not, when you turn this into an estimator and you're sampling, you have to make sure what you're sampling is sufficiently sparse. Like it's not so dense that it you need an exponentially large number of samples.
Okay.
That's where I would draw the cutoff. But in practice, you know, in practice, that depends. Depends on how many qubits you have and everything like that. So this works. Thank you. that's all fine and dandy. Do we care about wave functions that have this property? You know what the class of Hamiltonians that has this type of wave function is called?
What's the question?
The type of Hamiltonians of this wave function. Anything you're interested in? I can't hear you.
Time reversal symmetric?
Time reversal symmetry implies a real wave function, but it doesn't imply that it's all positive. So it's close. It's what we call stochastic Hamiltonians. You ever heard that word? Forget it. Forget it. No, don't forget it. So positive real functions are the ground states of what we call in QMC literature, I think, non-sine problematic. It's kind of like or stochastic. Stochastic, but quantum stochastic. Blame Barbara Turhall and Sergey Bravi for this one. It's a basis-dependent statement. It means that computational basis. So what does it mean? So whatever I'm calling sigma, computational basis. So in that computational basis, all the off-diagonal elements of the Hamiltonian are positive. So that's a huge class of problems. Anything that's like an anti-ferromagnetic. Wait, positive or negative?
Negative.
Well?
Negative.
Damn. Oh yeah, it's when it's minus beta H, that's when it's positive. So yeah, that makes sense with this. So if I have a spin, let me do a SU2 invariant spin Hamiltonian. That's what we call ferromagnetic. Then this is stochastic. Yeah, that's right. So ferromagnetic means you don't have frustration on certain lattices. Anything like a transverse field Ising model. So if I have sigma z minus whatever gamma sigma x, that's a stochastic Hamiltonian. So any Hamiltonian that you can find this basis and write such that the off-diagonal elements are negative, you can train with a classical, completely classical restricted Boltzmann machine. So I think what the interesting question is can you find that basis in polynomial resources? But that's another question. There are, of course, wave functions that exist that are ground states, say, of Hamiltonians, or states in the spectra that you're interested in, perhaps, that aren't all positive, real and positive. And you can still use a restricted Boltzmann machine. So this is one class of problems that's basically easy to reconstruct with a Boltzmann machine. Also, if the wave function is generally complex, then RBMs can still be used. But now you really have to find a parameterization somehow of the phase, right? So if I have some basis that I'm interested in, And my wave function looks like this. Then clearly, my measurements that are drawn in just that computational basis, you know, big P, right? That's the target distribution for measurements in that basis, which are governed by Born rule. Clearly, I don't know if it's clear, these don't have information on that phase, right? So this tells you right away that the way that we've constructed this problem to take measurements in some basis, you know, won't be sufficient to reconstruct the complete, you know, all the information of the wave function here. It's the same as the tomography problem, right? I'm just talking about a pure wave function here. I'll show you examples where we can reconstruct mixed states. So the basic strategy with the RBM is just to parameterize that phase somehow and to obtain measurements in enough bases that you can get an accurate reconstruction of that wave function using the procedure we talked about. So I'll just say a couple words about this and then we'll look at some data. So, strategy. How do you parameterize the phase? You can take an RBM, you can presumably use any function approximator, and just tie it on there somehow. You could use complex weights and biases. Complex weights, probably. Sorry. Complex parameters. This is the strategy taken by Giuseppe Carleo. If you read the literature, you can also do what I'll show you how to do is just to take another Bolzmann machine and parameterize the phase with that. RBM. How would that look? So I'll save my parameters lambda, which are the weights and biases for the amplitude. So I can imagine having another set, which I'll call mu. Which will give me P lambda. EDI phi. Like that, see? It's like I have a visible, I'm calling these sigma. I have hidden units for the amplitude, fully connected. This is my lambdas. Then I have another set for the phase. So this is, what did I say? Amplitude phase. You need to train, in this case, using projective measurements in different bases. Okay, just like I said, so you can imagine specifying a basis for each, I'll call it a vector. So I could have a basis vector for each. I'm not gonna draw the vector sign. But I can imagine the unitary transformation that takes me from one basis to another. Sigma B. That's sloppy. Sigma. Where B is a vector because this basis has to be in principle different for every single measurement that I'm taking. Can it be different for every, you know, the unitary that transforms me from my computational basis could be different for every qubit. So it could be a Hadamard that takes me from sigma z to sigma x, say, on one qubit, and then the other qubit, there's no Hadamard. So then I would have a, you know, an x, z, blah, 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 rotate into x, y, z bases. How many bases are required for tomography on a wave function in general?
D squared minus one?
I don't know, I'm seriously asking.
I think it's D squared minus one, that's like...
What's D?
D is the dimension of your wave function, or the Hilbert space.
Okay. Some number of bases needed? For I would say for informational completeness. And of course, in some cases, it's one, right? So you could have I don't even know. The question of how many bases are required for different structure of wave functions, I really don't think it's fleshed out all that well. But what you can do is you can take bases, you can do reconstructions of observables, and you can see how well they converge, basically, numerically. And that's a good way, maybe that's the only way for many practical cases of interest of trying to figure out how many bases are required. So just the last thing I'll say is, how does the training work? So one reason I like attaching an additional RBM to represent the phase with these additional parameters mu here is because you can use essentially contrastive divergence and the KL Kullback-Leibler divergence training, just like I talked about last class, on those additional measurements and other bases to populate the phase. So when I'm talking about phase, I'm talking about phi up there. The additional bases, I'm just going to drop the vector over B. So you can imagine getting obtaining a data set where the, say, experimentalist has done this rotation, with some single site addressing technique, qubit by qubit. So. So given that data set, given D equals, you know, a data set and all these different bases, oh, I wrote something confusing here. I wrote vectors over those. That was supposed to be a different basis for every. This is a vector over spins, like, so this is a single element of the training set, you can imagine. I think I shouldn't have vectors over here, right? The vector represents, so now I have vectors here. I don't even know how to do this notation. So I'm mixing my subscripts here, but each one of these is like a n qubit configuration, right? And so my data set would have a whole bunch of these up to, say, m, which is the size of the set. Each one of these can have different bases, m. So then what you do is you calculate a cost function, which you can derive from a Kullback-Leibler divergence in every different unique basis. And if you go through the same steps we went through before for a single basis, one strategy, which isn't the only one, is to just essentially sum all the log likelihoods in a way like this. To give you a cost function. So sigma e and e log. You'd have to put that unitary transformation in. Sigma b sigma. Lambda mu. This is my computational basis. I don't know, something like this, plus a complex conjugate. So as long as you know what basis you've taken the measurement in, right, then you're going to basically apply that unitary inside the Kullback-Leibler divergence and do all of your training in the same way that we've done previously. That's just a flavor of how you do it. Again, how many bases are required, how many measurements in each basis is required, and even how many parameters are required in the machine, those are all things that you don't know a priori, right? That's something you have to discover through, and I think in these cases, a lot of trial and error. Okay, Josh, are you listening? Can you lower the screen? That's right. Nobody's watching this lecture. That would have been cool if it worked. Did it change the lights? So what is the story with the black hole?
They took a picture. It's kind of blurry.
So when this pops up, I'm going to go back to the first thing I mentioned in lecture, which is the 2D Ising model. We'll just build it up from there.
Does this scale for when the dimension of the on-site Hilbert space is greater than 2?
Sure, but again, it depends on the structure of the wave function. Like, there's nothing in the formalism that says it won't scale, but there could be something in the wave function that says you need, you know, an exponential number of measurements to be information complete. But, you know, who knows?
There it is. It's like an orange donut.
The black hole, the thing in the middle?
Yeah.
Lauren, what do I do? How do I turn everything on? Do I have to specify this thing?
Yeah.
Magic. Everything you touch. Okay. It's data from a few years ago that Giacomo took on This is one of the first things we tried training. So this is a one-dimensional classicalizing model using CD5, which means five steps in your contrastive divergence. So when you're estimating the negative phase every training step, you run the block Gibbs sampling for five steps, and you just take those visible and hidden units and you plug it into that second term of the cost function. Now the cost function's balancing, you know, fitting to the data and all, you know, versus, or you know, configurations generated or seen in the data versus those generated. You're balancing those two things, learning and unlearning. This is the exact KL divergence. So the reason we started with six spins is because you can also calculate the entropy of the data set. I remember the KL divergence has the entropy of the data set and the log likelihood. So for larger numbers of spins or qubits, that entropy calculation becomes intractable and you have to throw that piece away. Right? So then you'll get, so there's like a constant shift in the KL divergence. So in this case, you know, as a function of number of training steps, and you use stochastic gradient descent, so you pull out a certain number of data elements out of your data set that's a mini batch. You train with a certain amount of epochs. This is probably epochs, whatever. And this is in principle going to zero, right? If converging to zero. But if you throw out that entropy of the data set, you know, you see a shape of a curve, you see that it's converging, but you can never confirm that you're really getting the true global minimum, you know, of the KL divergence. This is just some distribution, representation of that distribution. And you can see as a function of 10 steps, 500 steps, how you're converging to the exact case.
What's the x-axis? What?
This must be number of, it's probably 64 spins. I don't know why it's different. So it's just the distribution of, well, it must be configured number of, this must be sigma vector, right? So.
You think this is like a 2 to the
2 to the, that doesn't, no, right? What's 2 to the 6?
2 to the 5 is 30.
Okay, that's what it is. It's 2 to the 6. It's the configuration, right? How probable that configuration is. So it's the same system. So, I mean, I don't know. You never look at the probability distribution, but you can see how it converges there. I don't know if that's interesting. I think the estimators are really what you should be looking at. These are estimators, yeah, so here's 64, this is a 2D, this is an 8x8 lattice now. So this is a two-dimensionalizing model, and instead of looking at the KL divergence or the distribution itself, we're looking at the energy and the specific heat defined as estimators over the visible units only, right? And what those, okay, so this data was generated from a Ising, or from a Monte Carlo, like a conventional Monte Carlo method for the 8x8 Ising model. And so you can calculate the energy or the specific heat exactly using that method, right? Everything's diagonal, everything's classical. So what we're looking at here is how the estimators that are calculated from the trained RBM, right, after training, converge as a function of how many hidden units you have. So if you don't have enough hidden units, you don't have enough expressive power, like you don't have enough parameters in your machine to basically fit the data or, you know, to fit the underlying distribution. So if you only have four hidden units, that's the pink, you can especially see in the specific heat, you know, which is a fluctuation quantity, this number is special. This is the critical point. So this is where your correlation length diverges, this is where, you know, your system becomes scale invariant. You can especially see there that you're somehow overestimating the specific heat if you only have four hidden units. And as you have 16 hidden units, you get closer to the exact value. And basically when you get to 64 hidden units, which is one hidden unit per physical spin, you've essentially converged within error bars. So that's basically, you know, what I was saying at the start of class is you need one hidden unit per bond to exactly represent the underlying distribution. This is half that number, so it's, you know, roughly, you know, it looks like it's scaling the way you would expect it. As you get out to the, you know, the fully polarized state, that's like a ferromagnet, or you go to the, you know, completely random high temperature state, then you need way less hidden units. There's in some sense way less information that you have to, or far less correlations that you have to capture by the Boltzmann machine. Here's a positive real wave function. So this is the transverse field Ising model. This is what I wrote over there. So it's sigma z, it's minus gamma sigma x. That's a stochastic Hamiltonian. So the off-diagonal elements are negative. And so therefore, you can train with samples only in the sigma z basis, just like I did in the previous case. So all that training is for this model is essentially exactly the same as for the classical 2D Ising model. This is what I derived on the board. That's diagonal expectation value of diagonal operator, off-diagonal operator. And this is supposed to convince you that it works. Okay, so this is the, there's several things here. So here's the exact values for the expectation value of the Z or X magnetization. Okay, so this is Z, this is X. These are obtained with exact, you know, quantum Monte Carlo methods. So this is 144 qubits. As you increase the transverse field, you basically kill, you know, the sigma, the, you know, the polarization in the Z direction, and you turn on the magnetization kind of in plane. These are reconstructions with a restricted Boltzmann machine for Z and X. Now I forget how many hidden units and everything's in these reconstructions. But the point of this is that this is an off-diagonal operator. You've trained, you know, in the Z basis, and you've obtained through this local estimator an expectation value in the off-diagonal direction. Cool? Oh yeah, this is my favorite part of the whole thing. Say you don't trust that, and you wonder if you've missed something, you know, with all this basis nonsense. You can use a basis-independent quantity, and the best one I think is the entanglement entropy. So you can calculate the entanglement entropy from essentially the classical restricted Boltzmann machine. So this is the same transverse field Ising model. We did this in one dimension with 20 qubits. And this is the second Reni entropy. So it's not the von Neumann entropy. It's the, you know, the trace rho squared. So rho A means that I'm measuring the entanglement entropy between a system that has two bipartitions, A and its complement. And this is the size of that bipartition. So if there's one qubit in it, two qubits in it, all the way up to 10, it's symmetric. And that's a second Reni entropy for different field values. So this is gamma something, gamma something, gamma something. I don't know what it is. So you can look at the second Reni entropy, say with exact diagonalization here. And so we've compared the trained restricted Boltzmann machine to the exact diagonalization. By the way, the second Reni entropy is obtained by taking the restricted Boltzmann machine and replicating it, and then swapping configurations between the replicas in region A. That gives you, you know, you calculate that expectation value, it gives you expectation value of the purity. You take the log of that, it gives you the second Reni entropy. So that measurement is scalable. The von Neumann entropy is not, because basically you have something that's like a local estimator that's like a density matrix. So that's the same as calculating an a conventional entropy. But any integer Reni entropy you can calculate like this. So this tells you that, you know, it's a basis independent quantity. It tells you that you're not missing anything, right? And keep in mind, you've only trained this thing in the Z basis. So that's cool. That's a transverse field Ising model. Here's real experimental data. This is from Misha Lukin's group at Harvard. So they have Rydberg atoms. So the Rydberg atom, I think they're rubidium 87. So you prepare the atom in its ground state, and they call that a disordered state. But every single atom, I think there's 51. Is that the one? I forget the title of this paper. It's like, I don't know, 51 qubits, whatever. Somebody's counting, right?
Catchy.
So what? Yeah, and I think the trapped ion people came up with like a 53 ion paper after this. So whatever. So every Rydberg atom can be prepared in its ground state or its Rydberg state, and Rydberg state is just a highly excited state. You can tune You can basically tune the distance between the atoms so that these Rydberg states interact. It's like Rydberg blockade, they call it. So if you know, depending on the distance that the atoms are in this optical lattice, you can make it so that here's a ground state, here's a Rydberg state, here's a ground state. You can make it so that like nearest neighbor Rydberg atoms want to repel, right? And so that atom falls into its ground state. And you can adjust these to get different ordered. It's like a phase diagram as a function of detuning. So detuning, so if you look at this Rydberg Hamiltonian, you have an interaction. This is the occupation, this is the occupation. You have something that looks like a transverse field. By the way, I guess the sign of the transverse field is wrong there, but there's a simple unitary that makes it stochastic, this Hamiltonian. So it's a rotation on every single site or something like that. So you can be confident that the ground state wave function in this basis is positive definite. You can do a reconstruction with a restricted Boltzmann machine. Oh, here's more about the experiment in case you're interested. You get 3,000 projective measurements per detuning parameter. So that gives you an idea of the size of the data set that you're dealing with. It's actually not that much data. We assume, there's no phase, blah, blah, blah. Train their RBM and produce estimators, so this is what it looks like. So I've had these plotted in like transverse fieldizing model language, basically. So this is the detuning. This is tuning through the phase diagram. You're going from the fully polarized case on the left to the Z2 case on the right. So the phase transitions around delta equals zero. Experiment is the experiment because they can measure, their computational basis is occupation number for the Rydberg atom. Right, so you can take, and this is actually an 8-atom system, so we didn't do the full 51. So there you can do essentially exact diagonalization because it's only 8 qubits. And so you can compare the model for that Hamiltonian to the experiment, which is the black line, to the reconstructed RBM. And everything should match. This is basically what the experimentalists would usually look at. We're sort of confirming the RBM. Hopefully works here. But here's the off-diagonal magnetization. So this is basically the entire point of all this, is that this is not something that can easily be reconstructed in a scalable manner, directly from the data. So this is the model, and this is what the RBM gives for this off-diagonal magnetization. So you can see that there's some discrepancy there. And so that, again, that's the point. You're hoping that you can give feedback to experimentalists in terms of verification and so on of the state that they're trying to produce. This is the second Rényi entropy for different bipartitions, 2, 3, 4. And again, we're comparing exact diagonalization to reconstructions in one of these restricted Boltzmann machines. You see, it works pretty well. It's not perfect. And what's neat about this is if you step back and think about it, what you've done is you've, again, taken just projective measurements in the occupation basis, the Rydberg basis, and you've reconstructed this basis-independent second Rényi entropy. Oh yeah, the way this was done before was like this. So this is, you guys know Radjabal at IQC, this is one of the reasons he's famous, is he did this replication and swap method experimentally. So an actual, atom trap, two identical copies. He did I think the original experiment was two copies of four, atoms in a one-dimensional chain, a physical swap operator using that thing, whatever that is. And that produced this plot for the second Rényi entropy. It's a different Hamiltonian, but going through a Mott transition. So one of the points with the RBM is that if you get good reconstruction in the RBM, you can throw away Radjabal's optical table and do everything virtually kind of within the stochastic neural network. Just a couple of slides on complex wave functions. So this is what I wrote on the board. You have X instead of sigma. But the green is the visible layer. Now I'm going to train an amplitude with lambda parameters. There's the weights. And the dotted lines on top are the parameters for the phase. There's the log likelihood that I drew on the board. You sum over the number of bases, sum over the number of elements in that basis. I might have forgot one of those sums. And the point is that you need measurements. If you're reference basis is Z, then you've applied a Hadamard here to get this data set. You know, so you have to have a whole bunch of measurements in this basis. The question is how many bases you need and so on. Same thing, stochastic gradient descent. And there's just some details that you can read about how training is done. We typically do an amplitude first, then phase, back and forth. I've shown this picture before. This is training on a synthetic data set produced by a W state. So it's a W state, but there's local phases applied, which is those thetas, theta 1, theta 2, theta n. I don't know, just some artificial state. And so this is just demonstration that you can reconstruct this on 20 qubits to some degree of accuracy. It's actually a relatively small number of measurements. And here it's a total of 2n minus 1 bases. So the number of bases to produce this. What this is the colors mean nothing. This is your 20 qubits. And each one of these is the phase between 0 and 2 pi. So you're supposed to see those two figures and say, oh, they look the same. Be impressed. The final thing I didn't talk about was if you have a mixed state. So if you're really interested in, I don't know, verification of quantum hardware in the lab, you know, the assumption of purity will give you problems. But you can purify a restrictive Bolson machine, just the same way you do any sort of purification. So the way you do it is by just adding additional weights and biases. So that blue box on the bottom was the RBM from the last slide, which is separate parameters for amplitude and phase. You basically do a purification step by adding ancillary units, okay, until you have enough parameters in the RBM that red, the ancillary units essentially purify your state. Then you can trace those things out. That procedure, as far as I know, on top, isn't scalable. So we haven't yet made that to work for wave, for general wave functions in a way that scales very well. So there's still exponential problems there. But I just wanted to advertise some of Juan Carrasquilla's recent work, where he does have a scalable way to do density matrix, if you want to call it tomography or reconstruction, with generative modeling, with some additional complications. But this is another reason I want to mention this is, okay, it's a scalable method constructed by combining a tensor network with a generative model. What Juan found is that RBMs aren't necessarily the best generative model in all of these cases. So here, it's a different parameterization of the density matrix. I'm not explaining what this is. But the point is that I think RNNs, these recurrent neural networks, were the generative model that gave Juan sort of the best performance. And so the point with this is tomorrow, Michael Albergo is going to talk about different generative models. And what you should think about is like what you've learned with RBMs and how you might do this type of reconstruction with different generative models.
What would be like the sequence that you model on? Because your RNN would be...
You pick a sequence of qubits spatially.
Oh, okay.
That's one way to think about it. Yeah, RNNs are typically one-dimensional sequences. But yeah, they're very powerful generative models. They give you exact, likelihood estimations. They give you exact sampling instead of some sort of statistical sampling like we have with RBMs. So all these different generative models give different, pros and cons. And we talked about RBMs for 2 days, but it's just because I think that's something that's really familiar to us as physicists. There's no reason that these other generative models can't be used for exactly this type of reconstruction. Oh, and just to show you that density matrix reconstruction works, this is on some of Kevin Resch's data. This must be three entangled photons, right? And they have filters in horizontal and vertical. So you have these different bases. This is instead of X and Z, it's HH, HH. Should there be nine? Like an 8x8 density matrix, whatever. So this is basically a reconstruction of the experimental density matrix using that simple purification technique with a restricted Bolson. So you can basically you can calculate things like fidelities and so on, in the same way you do regular tomography, using these types of methods. Is there anything else I want to say? Scaling studies, that's interesting. This is the minimum number of hidden units required For different numbers of qubits for the transverse field Ising model at the hardest point to learn, which is the critical point. So you can see that the number of hidden units is linear. It scales linearly with the number of qubits. So that's the representational capacity requirement for your machine. This is the minimum number of measurements. This is only for one basis required to reconstruct the transverse field Ising model at its critical point. Again, it's linear. So in order to ask how much resources are required for these types of strategies, the only thing we've been able to do is basically generate synthetic data and then do scaling studies on the machines themselves. So this looks like it's all pretty preliminary stuff in some sense, but I think the reason is because this is like, I don't know, there's a lot of unknowns. It's kind of the frontier of what people are thinking about with these generative models. And so I just think I'll leave you with that idea that there's a lot to do. So have fun tomorrow with Albergo. He'll tell you about all the state-of-the-art modern generative modeling techniques. What else is going on? Tomorrow at 11 a.m., we have a machine learning seminar by Sebastian Wetzel. And so attend that if you can. He'll be asking about if you can trust phase diagrams produced by machine learning. Is he here? No. Hey, I forgot his title. So. And that's it. Any questions?
Guys, let's thank Roger for his
All right, thanks, guys.